You're listening to The Leonard Lopate Show on AM 820 and 93.9 WNYC.
The state of Pennsylvania is host to over 6,000 active wells extracting natural gas and oil from deep within the earth through hydraulic fracturing. For the people living near these fracking sites, life has never been the same, with residents reporting nosebleeds and headaches, and that their pets and cattle have experienced frequent stillbirths and, in some cases, sudden death soon after gas wells became active in their areas. For their new book, The Real Cost of Fracking, How America's Shale Gas Boom is Threatening Our Families, Pets, and Food, veterinarian Michelle Bamberger and pharmacologist Robert Oswald interviewed residents and investigated the connection between their sudden illnesses and the fracking going on nearby. The book is published by Beacon Press. I'm very pleased to welcome Michelle Bamberger and Robert Oswald to our show today. Hello.
Hello. Thanks for having us, Leonard.
How did you get involved in this project?
Well, that's a question I've been asked often, and I have to think back. When it first started was in 2009. We read an article in our local paper about a website where people had gone out and done a lot of research on leases. And they mapped all the leases in Tompkins County, which is our county.
That's in upstate New York.
Yes, it is. And they mapped all the leases so that anyone who went to the website and looked up that link could see where they lived and what was leased around them. And we quickly learned that we were surrounded by large landowners that had leased their surface and or mineral rights to this process.
Well, isn't fracking still an issue that's up for debate in New York State? In other states, it seems to have been resolved, but Governor Cuomo still hasn't given it a definitive answer, although many people assume he's going to give it the okay.
I
added too many things into that question?
I would think that perhaps you added a little bit too much. We don't really know what he's going to say. Right now, there's the Department of Health review, which is a totally opaque process. We know very little about what's going on there or when we're going to hear anything. So right now, we have no idea.
But there's still fracking going on in parts of New York State. Or just areas have been leased, but the fracking hasn't occurred?
There are areas that have been leased. And actually, it is possible to do fracking in New York State. They just need to have an environmental impact statement for each well. Or it is also possible to do propane fracking, which is not water-based in New York State. But none of that's really going on right now.
What attracts these drill companies to Pennsylvania is the same thing that attracts them to upstate New York?
Well, the shale layers are deeper there. The better part for them to drill is runs across a swath of Pennsylvania, and that happens to be the same swath where our cases came from. So it's much, I guess, easier for them to retrieve or extract the gas than it would be from where we are. Actually, in Tompkins County, there are parts of the county that are better than others, but for those parts in Pennsylvania that are looked at as the best places, it's easier to extract.
Well, where you are, there's also a major wine industry, among other things. Wine is not a big product of Pennsylvania. What are they growing there?
Well, in Pennsylvania, it's a large dairy industry there. They have beef cattle.
They have dairy cattle and chickens, and it's a large agricultural area. And what happens with the gas drilling for this process is they tend to go to agricultural areas, rural areas where they can spread out. And these are the people, these are the folks that we've interviewed that have been affected.
Well, there are some places where landowners are not living there. They're just simply leasing out their property.
Right, and they have. We've had several people where it's not. They have bought. Their property sits on land that the mineral rights have been leased. So they've been. They have. They're not getting any benefits out of this at all.
Who's leased it then?
A farmer who owned it before, mm-hmm. who kept that part of the lease, who kept the mineral rights, sold them the surface rights, and moved on. And people sometimes got those leases. Thinking, okay, it won't be developed, or this is such beautiful farmland. And that's actually one of the stories we have in the book, Leonard, where we talk about that. People spent all of their money, their life savings, to buy this land, to develop it, to have farmland, to realize that soon after they started, within a couple years, drilling started there, and their lives were turned upside down.
Is this just simply a transaction between the landowners and the drilling companies? Or do local governments get involved as well?
It is a transaction between the landowner and the company. In New York State, it's a little bit different, though. In Pennsylvania, I won't go into the details because it's fairly complicated. But in New York, it's a little bit simpler. In New York State, if they can, they define what's called a drilling unit. It's about 1 square mile or something like that. And if 60% of the landowners or 60% of the land is leased, then indeed the state steps in and integrates the rest of the land. So if you decide that you don't want your land drilled under, you really don't have a choice. You're integrated into that, and they pay you the lowest amount of royalty possible.
And so that's compulsory integration. So getting back to your original question, once we learned that we were surrounded by landowners who had leased, we realized we were in on this no matter what, and we would be drilled under.
Well, that's an incentive for people to go along with the leasing, because if they oppose it, they're just going to get a lower price.
That's true. On the other hand, sometimes you're just told that your neighbors have been leased. May or may not be true.
What makes shale a rich area for natural gas deposits?
Well, shale is really was once in this case, the Marcellus Shale, which we're talking about in most cases, was once an ancient ocean where there were sea life and that sort of thing, and it was compressed, and eventually the organic matter turned into methane.
Well, Pennsylvania is where the first oil drilling in this country occurred in the 19th century. Are we talking about the same oil or the natural gas that goes with oil?
Certainly natural gas does go with oil. That type of drilling was different, though. That was where there was they were looking for pockets of gas.
And they put up those oil rigs.
And put the oil rigs up. And that was actually a fairly simple process. And this is a much more complicated process.
Michelle, how long has fracking been going on in the United States? Okay. Robert, how long has fracking been going on in the United States?
Well, it depends on how you define things. Certainly, the first fracked oil and gas well was probably done in the 40s. However, what we're talking about here is a much larger and different process in some sense. It's still the same. You fracture the rocks. But in this case, they're using enormous quantities of water, sand, and fairly toxic chemicals to shatter the shale. So it's different. What's been going on in the last few years is quite different from what happened in the 40s.
So this is the gas and oil that are retrieved by fracturing the shale.
Yes.
And they use water to do that.
Right.
And then what happens when the stuff comes up to the surface? How is it transported? How is it stored?
Yeah, well, that's a good question, and that's where a lot of the problems come in. So they're injecting millions of gallons of water, chemicals, sand into the ground. That comes back up, but not only that comes up, but many chemicals that were stored in the ground, heavy metals, radioactive material, comes up to the surface, and it's a large quantity of water. That can be stored in wastewater ponds that can leak. It's been transported and injected into injection wells, which in some cases have caused minor and sometimes not so minor earthquakes.
In the book, you mentioned conventional and unconventional wells. What's the difference?
So conventional wells would be what Robert just described, Leonard, where there are pockets of gas and it's low volume amounts of water and chemicals that are used, whereas this is the process that we're talking about that started in the late 90s, actually, in this country. Very high volumes of water, much higher amounts of chemicals and toxic chemicals, and a lot more sand. So everything is a much, much higher and more intensive operation.
And horizontal drilling
And horizontal is added to that.
It used to be you go as deep as possible to get the stuff out. Now we're going horizontally.
We can go horizontally. So that really allows a much larger amount of this fossil fuels to be extracted.
Are there other types of fracking besides hydraulic?
Oh, yes, yes, certainly.
Would they be safer?
That's not absolutely clear. There's been fracking with high-pressure nitrogen. There's been fracking with propane. But nevertheless, what is down in the shale layer still comes up to the surface. And Some of that, like we say, it's radioactive bacteria. Sometimes bacteria come to the surface, sometimes heavy metals. So it's not necessarily safer.
The people in the area that you investigated get their water from wells. So is the water from the fracking leaking into their wells?
In some cases, it's been shown that some chemicals are there that should not have been there, Leonard. And that gets to be a really complex question, especially when we look at chemicals, because a lot of these tests were not complete initially. So unless you did a really complete test on a pre-drill, you can't really tell if it was there or not post-drill.
Why aren't those tests done pre-drill?
Well, that's a good question.
Is that happening now?
Well, it's difficult to do and still is impossible to do now because we don't know what all the chemicals are that they're using. That information is not available, certainly pre-drill. And even post-drill, there are still chemicals that we don't know about because of proprietary blends. We simply don't know. There's a website called Frac Focus that the industry will point to saying, look, here's what we use. But if you look at that carefully, it's not complete. It's voluntary, and it's always done after completion, so people really can't do complete pre-drill testing.
But can't we find out what chemicals they're using after the fact by simply looking at the water and seeing what's there? They're not revealing what they are doing because they say that would make it easier for the competition. But everybody probably knows how to do this who's in this business.
Well, yeah. I mean, The issue goes a little bit further than that, and that is that it's not just what gets put in the ground. Things get put in the ground, and then there are chemical reactions in the ground that change them. There are things that are brought back up from the shale that are ill-defined. So it's a much more complicated process than you'd think.
My guests are Robert Oswald and Michelle Bamberger. Their book, The Real Cost of Fracking, How America's Shale Gas Boom is Threatening Our Families, Pets, and Food, is published by Beacon Press. In one of the first chapters, you speak to neighbors Sarah Valdez and Josie Biderman. What did Josie tell you about her animals?
Josie is a breeder, a dog breeder, and also has horses that has barrel racing. And her animals were affected in association with gas drilling processes and wastewater. Her water was also affected. She noticed that, and that's really described how her water quality changed, but also
the taste, you mean?
And the quantity most drastically in her case changed. And her neighbor, of course, the quantity didn't drop. They kept drinking it. Her quality did change. It was very subtle.
There have been films made of people putting, getting their water to go on fire. And I recently read some politician said that burning water is just a natural kind of thing. It goes all the way back to the Bible.
Well, actually, that's true. And if you look at our water in Ithaca, New York, we do have methane in it. So it is true that there are some cases where it's quite natural. However, what we're talking about in many of these cases is a drastic increase in methane in the water after drilling. And in those cases, you know, your water can go from perfectly nice and clear, pure, to looking like 7-Up and being explosive.
Sarah's son David had been ill for some time when you spoke with her. What was wrong with him?
So David had a classic signs of arsenic poisoning. But because that's so unusual in the public in general, unless there's been a massive exposure or, David was not an industrial worker, his doctor really hadn't thought of those things. But once his doctor got the lowdown of what was happening to the animals, especially in relation to the gas drilling that was going on, this really led him to further testing that really showed that.
And aren't children and animals more likely to be affected?
Right, they are. First of all, they're both sort of sentinels in a way, especially animals, because they have higher exposure rates. Their reproductive times are faster. And children cannot really metabolize these toxins as easily as adults do. They also have higher exposure rates than adults.
What caused Sarah's family to lose their sense of smell?
That's a known factor that goes along with the BTEX compounds. So benzene, toluene, ethylbenzene, and xylene are volatile organic compounds that are very much associated with this process. And if you look in the literature for medical conditions related to those chemicals, you will see that they do affect neurological systems, and neurological systems being sense of smell, sense of taste. Those systems are affected in people who live in these intensively drilled areas.
My guests are Michelle Bamberger, a veterinarian and the author of two books on first aid for cats and dogs, and Robert Oswald, professor of molecular medicine at Cornell University. They serve on the advisory board of Physicians, Scientists, and Engineers for Healthy Energy, and they have written a book called The Real Cost of Fracking, How America's Shale Gas Boom is Threatening Our Families, Pets, and Food. It is published by Beacon Press. We will continue our conversation after we take a little break. We're back with Michelle Bamberger and Robert Oswald. Their book, The Real Cost of Fracking, How America's Shale Gas Boom is Threatening Our Families, Pets, and Food. It's published by Beacon Press. You don't have much. Do you have anything positive to say about fracking?
I think it's, you know, we do need energy, and that's, we hear that all the time. However, there are other ways for us to satisfy our needs of energy, and I think that we need to think beyond fossil fuels at this point.
Well, it still remains a matter of debate, and there are many people who, in fact, it's become a political football, hasn't it? There are many people who say that any arguments against fracking are really just kind of like the sky is falling.
Well, I think all you have to do, Leonard, is drive down into these areas and actually look around and see and ask yourself if you would want to live there. You know, it's great for the gas station owners or for the fast food owners. They're making out really well. But, you know, to actually live there in that community, especially and raise children and raise animals and raise agricultural products, you know, you really want to think twice about that.
What were the reasons that the Valdez family, for example, leased out their land for drilling in the first place?
Well, that's an interesting question, and I discussed that in the book. I asked all of these families when I met with them, you know, why did you lease, and do you feel it was worth it, and what good came out of it or what bad came out of it? And the reason that they leased was because they saw people around them that had leased or even had not leased and that had lost their water. With no recourse to getting bottled water or to getting a water buffalo, in other words, to getting their water replaced. And they knew that there were leases that they could have where there was a clause that said that if their water was changed, that the drilling company would be responsible for giving them bottled water and a water buffalo, which the cost of those things can really mount up, especially if you're looking over years. So they leased, those two leased with another family. So three of them went in together and had this clause put in on their contracts for that reason.
And what happened?
So they did. If you read the story, I won't give it away. You read the book. but you'll find out there are a lot of complexities there. And they did get water. They all got water at one point, but then they had water taken away. And so why did they have water taken away at one point? The water was taken away because of the testing and the state environmental regulatory group saying, okay, these tests show that there are no problems at all. It was not the drilling company's fault for your change in water. So things could still fall out even having a clause like that.
What has caused the earthquakes that we've heard about from Texas, Oklahoma, and other states in connection to fracking?
Okay, I think we have to, when we talk about fracking, we're talking about generally the entire process, not necessarily just breaking the rock. In this case, in the case of the Oklahoma and Arkansas and actually Ohio, there was even one in New York, those earthquakes, they're due to injection wells. So it's where they're trying to get rid of the wastewater, the huge volumes of wastewater, and they're injecting them deep into the earth. And if you inject them deep into the earth near seismically active areas, you can get earthquakes, sometimes significant earthquakes.
And you mentioned that in disposing of the toxic wastewater, some transportation trucks apparently let some leak out intentionally. Why would they do that?
You know, most of this is hearsay, obviously, but the reason they do that is they have so much fluid, they have to get rid of it somehow. And sometimes, you know, they get rid of it by letting it leak out of their truck.
In the case of Claire and Jason Wasserman, they noticed purple suds coming out of their sink. Is that typical?
I you know, that we've heard from other families, too, and I'm going to let Robert take over from here. But I think that what we'd heard from at least a friend who's a chemist on this is that manganese may cause something like that. And their water was high in iron and manganese. And again, keep in mind, Leonard, that it was testing that was incomplete. So there were many, maybe other things that were causing that purple color, maybe interactions between other chemicals. But we do know that manganese is a chemical.
Is that bad for
that.
Us? Iron, we need some iron in our diet. Do we need that much iron? But what about manganese?
Right. So the iron there is a level, and it's called a maximum contaminant level, and above which that is not good for your health, and below which is okay. So that you have too much iron, it's not good. Too much manganese, it's not good either.
Another couple you spoke to, Mary and Charlie Jameson, had animals that they sold for meat. So if the animals don't die, does that mean that the meat is okay?
No, it doesn't. And, you know, as long as animals can walk, then they will go to slaughter. But that certainly doesn't mean it's okay. We don't really know if it's okay because there's really no monitoring being done right now. There's the only monitoring that's being done in relation to fossil fuel extraction right now is after the Deepwater Horizon accident with seafood in the Gulf. And polycyclic aromatic hydrocarbons are being monitored, as well as DOSS, which is a marker for the Corexit that was used as an oil dispersant.
Did the Jamesons get any compensation from the drilling company for the loss of their cattle and
as far as I know, they did not. That's in litigation right now, and that has not been resolved.
Has anyone received compensation?
Not as far as I know. For animals, for sure, not.
Wouldn't compensation from a drilling company be something like an admission of guilt?
Most likely, and that may be why it's not happening.
Well, part of that is sometimes you can give compensation and say that it's not an admission of guilt. And in many cases, actually, what happens is there is compensation, but then the records are sealed, and the people sign non-disclosure agreements, and that's actually one of the big problems. I mean, when there are problems, generally there's compensation, and the case is shut off from further review.
Right. So, Leonard, I wouldn't say. I mean, that's right. What Robert said. So, I'm thinking of a case in Louisiana. It was in April of 2009. Where there were beef cattle exposed to hydraulic fracturing fluid, and that was perhaps the most dramatic case that we had, where these cows died within an hour after exposure to hydraulic fracturing fluid. So when I followed up on that case, what I had heard from the reporter on that case was that that farmer will never talk to you because he was paid off by the drilling company, and they do not want to tell you how much he was paid. So in answer to your question, was compensation ever made? Probably it has been, but I would have to say no from my point of view as documenting everything. Unless I've documented it, I cannot tell you if it has or has not happened.
My guests are Michelle Bamberger and Robert Oswald. Their book, The Real Cost of Fracking, How America's Shale Gas Boom is Threatening Our Families, Pets, and Food. It is published by Beacon Press. This is WNYC, WNYC.org. I'm Leonard Lopate. Hasn't there been debate over fracking in Europe as well?
Definitely. England is going through a very big debate, in Ireland as well. Poland has gone into it, hydraulic fracturing, in a big way, and there have been lots and lots of protests, even a movie made about it. So, yeah, it's a big issue all over the world. We've heard from people in Australia. We've heard from people in New Zealand. This is a worldwide issue.
And with the recent problems with Russia and the threat for many parts of Europe to lose Russian oil, This has become a bigger issue there as well. Absolutely. But in this country, don't we have a glut now of oil and gas? Why are fracking companies still pressuring people to open up their land when they're already getting a lot?
Oh, that's a really good question. The price of gas is very low right now. And the goal, actually, for the companies is to export it. So they're setting up export terminals, they're setting up pipelines to ship the gas to the coastline so they can export it. And what happens when they export it, they cool it to very cold temperatures in order to liquefy it. So it's basically right below its boiling point, so it's continually releasing methane. So this liquefied natural gas that's being exported actually is accompanied by quite a bit of methane release.
What happens when the people who are affected, the people that you have written about, go to their local governments or to the governor in Pennsylvania or the other states involved? Are they getting any help from the politicians?
Not really. There are some politicians in Pennsylvania. I think there's state representatives. There are a few who are starting to listen and to bring the people's side to the government. But what we're hearing is that apparently a lot of the fossil fuel industry gives money to these representatives, and so they're less likely to come forward and sign any legislation that would be more regulatory or might help these people out in these areas.
Isn't part of the problem that it's difficult to prove air and water contamination?
It's definitely difficult to do. But the problem really comes in is what do we accept as proof of contamination? And part of the problem is that the contamination often is variable, particularly with air, so it's hard to know exactly when to test. And sometimes you test and there's nothing there, another time you test and there's something there. And then the question is, you know, you may have quite a few different things at the same time, but yet the level that's considered dangerous is higher than what you see. But actually, the combination could be very damaging.
And who would do the testing? The fracking companies or the Pennsylvania Department of Environmental Protection?
Both, and as well as the EPA. We have several cases, Leonard.
Where's the EPA in all of this?
The EPA is doing a hydraulic fracturing study related to water contamination, and several of the cases that we have documented are involved in that study. So I was shocked to see, as someone who is documenting these cases, look at all of the chemicals that the EPA is testing for and see that most of them do not have primary maximum contaminant levels. In other words, the people could not go forward in litigation and prove that this chemical that's now present in their water, that is a chemical that is used in hydraulic fracturing fluid or drilling fluids, that even though it's present there, that they could not go forward and say that this is a problem because, for one, pre-drill testing was not done for that particular chemical, but also there is no primary maximum contaminant level, which means that legally they have no recourse.
What about the Clean Water Act?
Well, the problem with the Clean Water Act is that it doesn't apply directly to hydraulic fracturing operations. It actually never did, but there was a case actually that decided to change that, and it was in litigation at the time. While President Bush was in office, he had his vice president, Mr. Cheney, push through something that's now called the Halliburton loophole, which exempted permanently the hydraulic fracturing from the Clean Water Act.
Is Halliburton involved in hydraulic fracturing?
Oh, yeah, absolutely.
What kind of chemicals are we talking about? The ones that wouldn't there be there normally.
Right, so we're talking about biocides, things that would be killing the bacteria and other organisms that are locked in the shale that are going to be brought up. We're talking about friction reducers. We're talking about gelling agents that would help the chemicals slide through this rock. We're talking about propants like sand to keep silica to keep it open, many different chemicals, and a lot of them can be toxic. We're also talking about diesel fuel, Leonard, and diesel fuel is made up of these BTEX compounds, benzene, toluene, ethyl benzene, and xylene, and don't forget that benzene is a carcinogen.
In Colorado and Wyoming, the Environmental Protection Fund has proposed new regulation requiring groundwater testing and monitoring methane leakage, but it refrains from banning fracking. Is tighter regulation more realistic for the future of places like Pennsylvania as opposed to complete bans?
Well, there's tighter there are two things here. Tighter regulation, it would be a good thing, but all the regulation in the world does nothing unless it's enforced. And Pennsylvania is woefully inadequate in terms of enforcing the regulation. If drilling is instituted in New York, New York at this point is even worse.
In the course of your interviews, did you speak with any of the drilling companies?
I had interactions in one case with a drilling company to get some results. So I didn't speak directly with them. On that case, I did get results. But there was one panel that we were on, was it last year or the year before, Robert, where there was a drilling company representative, and we did get to speak with him directly afterwards. And there was definitely two sides of views presented there, so that audience got the full take on everything.
And what is his argument? We just need as much energy as we can get?
Well, the take on it is that it's a perfectly safe process. We need the energy. It's helping the country, et cetera. The question is, how do you prove that something is safe? I mean, we went for 30 or 40 years learning that tobacco was safe until it wasn't. And this is probably very similar to that.
How long do these rigs stay operational, and what happens to the sites after they've been exploited?
The industry take on it has, or if you read their literature, they say it's going to they're going to be exploited for the next 40 years. In fact, at least in, you know, Pennsylvania, in some parts of Texas, where the data suggests that the fall off in the production starts to occur almost immediately, and the well becomes unproductive after 5 or 10 years.
They suck it dry.
Yeah.
And the other side of that picture is what the owners of the land hear and what they hear, and it's in one of the stories we talk about there. They paint a pretty picture that it will be. All your land will be back to normal very soon. You won't even know there was a problem. You'll see just a little pipe sticking up, and this pipe will bring you riches, and you will be just fine.
Michelle Bamberger is a veterinarian, author of two books on first aid for cats and dogs, and Robert Oswald is a professor of molecular medicine at Cornell University. They serve on the advisory board of Physicians, Scientists, and Engineers for Healthy Energy, and they have written a book called The Real Cost of Fracking, How America's Shale Gas Boom is Threatening Our Families, Pets, and Food. It is published by Beacon Press. Thank you both so much for being on our show.
Thank you,
Thank you
very
for
much.
Having Enjoyed us, it. Leonard.